There is a site that my lectures are on if you want to go to. I didn't want to give them early in the course for fear that people would never show up, just listen to the lectures. But actually, that wouldn't have worked because they're these. So these right here. So you couldn't hear them until they happened already. So I didn't name this. A student in the high school offered his band space for this, and that's why we went with it. It's called armyoftruth.com/JonesLEX. So all one word, armyoftruth.com/JonesLEX for lectures. And it has not only everything we've done, but it has the stuff into World War II that I've done after school with them, and it has almost all, except for the Civil War, of a part one of the course. So if you ever need a part one of the course, it's on there too. And it's just as hard to hear as live. So it's authentic.
I can turn it off.
Yeah. With headphones, you can turn it off, yeah. So we were, what, at 11AB, something like that? I think I had jumped around a bit. And I can tell you this, there'll be no, to my knowledge, I think there's, no, that's a lie. I was going to say there's no test questions on the emergency banking bill, but there probably is. So to put that back into perspective of what I'd like you to know is that that first crisis that FDR faced upon taking office was the near collapse of the banking system. He called special sessions of Congress to meet and order a bank holiday in which federal bank inspectors authorized the reopening of some banks and kept closed those that were not sound and safe. That was in March of 33. By June of 33, the Glass-Steagall Act of number 16 had taken place, and I jumped down to 16 only for the purpose of, it's a common bank topic here, the creation of the Federal Deposits Insurance Corporation. So now, if we go back to 12, that's new material. Again, the easiest way, I think, to keep the New Deal programs in mind straight is under what category do they fall? Are they relief, recovery, or reform? And again, to explain that, relief means to provide temporary assistance to the unemployed in the form of a direct dole of money, emergency welfare money, or in the form of jobs created. Jobs that many times were quite controversial as to their value. One of those programs, the CWA, which is looks like not listed, but I think it could be tested. So, right there, we're going to do a lot of alphabet soup here in letters, but the CWA, or Civil Works Administration, is one of those programs that was looked at with a lot of askance for its value. It's almost like pile up rocks here and then hire another group after you leave to pile the rocks up back over here and rake the leaves back again. So, and what would be the purpose of hiring people to do jobs that surely had no market value and maybe not even needed to be done? Yeah, it was a way of trying to stimulate economic growth by providing relief, but also in a way where people felt a sense of dignity in terms of earning it rather than being dependent. So Civil Works Administration was, of the many works programs that existed, it was the most criticized for being probably makeup work, I think. Pardon? Yes, that's of the many public works programs. That one's not on the sheet that I, or if it is, I don't see it on there. The CWA Civil Works Administration. One that was of more value and still exists today is in number 12. There's two in number 12, but I'm going to look at the first one here. Civilian Conservation Corps. The Civilian Conservation Corps, all of these are first 100 days alphabet soup agencies. It hired male youth between age 18 and 25 to do outdoor work such as parks, recreation areas, soil conservation, reforestation projects. And it is as well as trying to take care of natural outdoor life areas that need, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you're just not going to make any money off of it in the private market. So it's going to be a government needed thing. And when times are hard, that's going to be left undone for quite a while. So that's a lot of way these things worked was public works projects, in this case outdoor forest areas, that don't make money and they just draw on the tax burden of people, now became something useful to put people back to work and redistribute money. And then by targeting these youth, they also, I hate to use this expression, but it's a get them off the streets program so that they're not in trouble causing problems elsewhere. And also kind of built into that, some of these people had been without work, and maybe their fathers had been without work for quite some time, so there was a degree of loss of discipline and loss of good training for how to hold a job. So they would teach them these skills of discipline and saving money. In fact, the way the program was set up was more than half the money was sent home to families rather than given to them at pay period. So it helped the family. It also prevented them from blowing it on a night on the town. It may, does it?
Part of it. Job Corps is just close by the Department of Labor. The CCC Kansas is their partnership between the Department of Labor and the Forest Service.
And they still exist, right? CCC still?
Yeah, the one that's in Ozark is actually an original CCC.
Wow. That is cool. That's fine. Next to it on number 12 is what's called the Public Works Administration. There will be another one later, 2 years later, called WPA, where the letters are reversed, but they're different words. But they will do essentially the same thing, just the second one's on a grander scale. The Public Works Administration was an infrastructure building program. So when you're thinking in terms of street buildings, sewer systems, courthouses, auditoriums, number of college campuses were built up larger. A lot of those old gray brick buildings in the University of Arkansas Fayetteville are PWA and later WPA projects. The Federal Emergency Relief Act, which set up administration, it had two parts. Its most immediate purpose was not even creating work, but just to distribute money to the needy, to the disadvantaged. And this is this form that's most controversial. Should the government be directly handing out money to the unemployed who have not earned it? Well, in that time period, it came back to that idea of in Annie, where FDR replied, in the long run, people don't eat. So, therefore, it was needed emergency. But FDR realized that there was a debilitating personal feeling that comes with just being on the dole, and so wanted to try to get these programs to take care of the emergency needs and finally get into longer-range, valuable creation of works programs. And
so it's just emergency money that was given to families.
Yeah, and this is where it contrasts so differently than the Hoover years, because the Hoover years, as little as possible federal involvement, but when it was this indirect lending of money to states or to businesses that would create jobs that hopefully would be marketable, and instead this is just directly to individuals. 14 takes us into the recovery area in farming. And this here is the harvest of McNary-Hagen. It's not set up the same way as McNary-Hagen, but it's trying to solve the same problems. And that is, what do you do with farm surpluses? Well, what the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933 proposed to do, two steps. First step would be to buy up everything the farmers had produced, and then the farmers make money that way, and then destroy a large amount of it. So here's people in need of food and milk and livestock, et cetera, in the cities, and it's destroyed and taken off. Then farmers would be paid to grow less than they could. So if you could, like, harvest tomatoes from 100 acres, you'd be paid to grow 60 acres instead of 100. What was the thinking here? Yeah, so that the shortages artificially created would cause price rises, and therefore what the farmers were actually getting in the market would be profit rather than cheaper to not even grow it, I think.
So the farmers would get paid both for their production and then
would
get paid again to produce more.
Yes.
So they got paid twice.
Yeah. The first, the purpose of the whole program is to create shortages, and if you have a surplus hanging around, people will want it, so you destroy it, and that creates the first shortage. Then a year later, the shortage is continued with less growth. So it's a crazy scheme, and seemingly they didn't pay teachers not to teach and automakers not to make automobiles, but they paid farmers not to grow. But this is the part of the New Deal that I guess is a bit convoluted, but everybody who complained about the New Deal argued that it flirted with, and it did, moving in the direction of creeping socialism. Yet many of these programs' purposes was to restore a healthy, normal, free market capitalist economy, and that was what its purpose was here.
I'm not like trying to be
that's
one side or the other, but
it's hard not to.
Was FDR's plan to make this kind of stuff
permanent?
That's
an excellent question. No, I really was. He, when asked if he was doctrinaire, if he was Keynesian, if he was liberal, etc., he always was very guarded against saying where he stood on some kind of permanent view on things. He said, we're doing emergency measures. We try this. If it works, we stay with it. If it doesn't work, we'll try something out. But I think it was always, we can tell from his writings that FDR hoped that once the economy came back to strength through market economics, that the government could back away from these programs. And a lot of them they did. I mean, a lot of these programs no longer are needed or exist. But then as the New Deal grew, things like government corporations like Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, those things did become permanent. I don't think it was his intent to have a permanent government presence in the economy, but it was this kind of thinking that where we can back away and health remains, we shall. Where we can't, we have to stay permanently. So I think that was the pragmatic outcome. And FDR politically underwent changes too, because I'd say before he was elected in 1932, he was not a flaming liberal. He was just a traditional Democrat who had an opportunity to win an election and deliver. But by the time that World War II had come around, I think he had kind of formulated not only a new view for the party, but for himself in regards to being a permanent liberal. So maybe that answers that.
Okay, back to this.
The first Agricultural Adjustment Act paid the farmers by charging a processing tax on food producers, such as millers and retailers and grocers, et cetera. So people who were involved in getting material from the farms into the retail markets or at the retail level, they paid extra taxes, and it was this money that was used to pay the subsidies to the farmers. And that became the basis of a great legal fight, and eventually the AAA was deemed unconstitutional. And while we're on that, if we can look at the next page.
So the retailers had to pay a processing
tax? To help the farmers not work. And what if we go back to our populist days? What does the 1890s? What does that kind of reflect back on or harken back to? The idea that the farmers are the victims of big business monopolists. So the tables are turned now, and those people who've been making all the profit off the farmers' hard work, so to speak, will help farmers out. They didn't like it. And if we look at number 29. The Butler case, Butler versus the U.S. of 1935, that Supreme Court case saw the Agricultural Adjustment Act overturned. There'll be a second one in 1938, but we'll come to that a bit later. Actually, maybe it would be useful to talk about it now because it makes 15 make sense. Talk about the second Agricultural Adjustment Act, which is listed up in number 36. It doesn't come until 1938. But the reason I bring it up is because it was, in part, not only a replacement for the first one that FDR didn't want to lose through a court battle, but it was also a response to something that had followed after the first one, the Dust Bowl effects. When the Dust Bowl of the drought and high winds and Kansas and Oklahoma, Texas soil flying everywhere to China, et cetera, occurred between 1935, 36, and 37. The passage of the second AAA was in hopes of a way to try to cope with stopping future degradation of soil quality by paying farmers not only not to grow, but instead to grow like nitrogen and reproducing legumes into the soil so that the soil would be useful in the future. And there was an effort to try to give special subsidies to those that would experiment with shelter belt tree planting to stop windstorms and contour plowing, these kind of things. In many ways, agricultural experts had a chance to experiment and see what can happen on a grand scale with federal money in the second AAA. This idea of shelter belt tree planting, I got to see firsthand. I don't know if I should share this with you or not. Two summers ago, my wife and I went to the Big Island of Hawaii, like I told you this, and did I tell you this whole story or not? Well, it's kind of embarrassing. When it comes to driving on mountain cliffs, I'm just super coward. I can't do the driving and I can't do the passengering on it. And I didn't realize that a trip to the Big Island was going to mean driving around volcano-type highways. So we rent this car, we get started, and a few hours into it, I'm just freaking. And finally, I just said, stop, leave me on the side of the road, you'll see your damn volcano, and come back 5 hours from now and pick me up, I'll still be here. And of course, that went over great with the family, so we drove back to the hotel where we were, and they're all mad and angry, my child and his girlfriend. We're going to take the car and go the next day, and my wife wants to go with them, but she's mad at me. So finally, she stayed, it's all this on tape here, and she stays back, and they go ahead and go off and venture and see the volcano, but we decided to take one of those airplane rides around the island. I mean, you know, driving on a cliff freaks me out. Yeah, it freaks me out. But in an airplane, a little cub where you could fall out the window, that was fine for me, I guess. And we did, and got to see the whole island and exciting views. She got sick and threw up. I'm sorry that happened. But he flew down to one area where the macadamia nuts grow. And as he flew around there, he showed how these tree plantings had been drawn from the Agricultural Adjustment Act's experiments as a way of keeping the wind from blowing the macadamia nuts off the bushes until they were ripe. So, firsthand AAA experience there. The Tennessee Valley Authority, back to 15. This concept of the Dust Bowl is captured very dramatically in John Steinbeck's 1930s book, The Grapes of Wrath, made into a movie in 1939, The Grapes of Wrath. And if you've seen The Grapes of Wrath, it just really does embody the despair of what it was like for people in Oklahoma, Kansas, and Arkansas who thought they had a better opportunity by moving to California to become fruit pickers and found life just as hard out there. But it's got some really interesting kind of metaphoric scenes in there where those who take care of them are equated with money changers, and those who come to their aid are kind of like symbolic of FDR's program. So these films that are always made in the I wish I had a course where the whole course was just watching films and then talking about what are the historic references you see in it. And when you watch the ones made in the time period, like Casablanca, to watch during World War II before World War II is even over, you get to see the optimism of hoping they win the war when they make the movie. And The Grapes of Wrath, a few years after the Dust Bowl's worst times, is still not that out of the Depression years. So if you get a chance to watch it, it's on TCM all the time. It's a good film about the Dust Bowl.
So,
it was this it's almost kind of like nature tends to follow human being screw-ups. Not only do we cause a major economic depression, but then there are droughts and high winds and high temperatures which destroy the growing fields of the Midwestern states. Maybe in another economic time it could have been coped with better, but it's people who depended upon growing something to pay off their mortgages couldn't, lost the farms, had them bulldozed under, and had to find work somewhere. But what an interesting thing about this is Will Rogers, Oklahoma comedian of the time, made the comment that in comparison to the economic problems of other countries in the world, other depressions going on, you could say Americans were the only country that was rich enough to drive to the poorhouse in their own automobile. The Tennessee Valley Authority, this is not on your test, and I always don't know what I'm talking about when I lecture it, but I'll give my best guess on this. This is a government corporation which really still exists today, and it was established to deal with the flooding of the Tennessee River, where it goes through Tennessee down into Mississippi, Alabama, and parts of Georgia. At one time, that area, the Tennessee Valley area, was the poorest of all parts of the United States, and the reason for it was you couldn't control the flooding and harness the water for any power use in a commercially profitable way. And so those people just dealt with it. It'd be like living next to the Nile and being flooded periodically with no warning. So these are one of those measures that remains permanent, and it probably, when they set it up, they realized it would never be a commercially viable thing on the open market. But it did harness the rivers and stop the flooding and also produce electrification for that area, which is connected to something that I'm also impressed with, is the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration, which brought electric lighting and power to people in farm areas that would otherwise would never have an access to it. So here's something that might be fun to do. I did this once. We drove over to eastern Arkansas in the nighttime, lost, but finally found our ways over there. And through all these small little country towns where all you see is a little house light and then another mile another house light. And think about what life was like before the Rural Electrification Administration. No access to power. What a different world it was. And surely it wasn't going to come from commercial providing. So this is kind of the essence of the New Deal, is there are certain things that are never going to be marketably available, but people deserve the right to have power. People deserve to have the right to have the safety and access. We did 16. 17, the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, creating the Securities Exchange Commission. What are securities? Stocks, stock market. So Securities Exchange Commission's job is to regulate the stock market practices and prevent such things as the market margin buying that we said before. That date, I believe, is correct, 1934. Below it, the NRA or the NIRA should have a 1933 date next to it because it is one of the original 100-day programs. This is the most controversial of all the New Deal agencies created, called either the NIRA or the just straight NRA because that was its first name before the I was added. Doesn't stand for the National Rifle Association. It stands for the National Industrial Recovery Act. It established committees of workers, business owners, and government officials who in each industry sat down and devised industrial codes, codes which mandated how many hours workers could and would work, what their wages would be, how much production the companies in a given industry would be expected to make or would be restricted to, what prices, ranges they could charge for their products. And since people from every avenue was involved in the decision making, it was supposed to be amiable, fair, and cooperative. It was the most hated of all the New Deal laws. By business owners, by workers, by consumers. What was the purpose of setting these codes of pricing and wages, and why was it so hated? Well, the purpose was... I'm sorry, go ahead. That's the second answer to this, is the belief that let's go to the second part. They felt like it deprived them of liberty, deprived them of their choices, that this is my business, should be able to pay and sell what I want, or I am a worker, I should be able to contract the number of hours. Yes, very much. It was price gouging on purpose in the way not to help the business. There's where the complaints are. That it was supposed to try to balance out the economic growth to create a stimulation of growth everywhere rather than one community making all the profit. But you would think that that would mean that labor would have been happy with it. They weren't happy either. They felt like that they could have bargained for better wages on their own. And there's also something that goes with committees telling you how to live. I think this, Americans are not comfortable with committee government unless you are head of the committee, I think. And so there was a lot of problem with that. Recognizing right away how much disenchantment there was with the codes, they went into a propaganda mode and started printing up large posters with the blue eagle on it. And behind the eagle would be a picture of a worker and a business owner who are kind of like shaking hands or arms around the shoulders saying, "We do our part." And those businesses that would portray these posters would get tax breaks. If in Hollywood you made a movie that had the blue eagle poster appear in it somewhere, you got a tax break. So the propaganda campaign trying to convince everybody that the good Americans, you know, support the Blue Eagle, support the NRA, and this didn't work. It didn't work at all. In fact, the NRA was finally overturned as an unconstitutional law in the same place that we saw the last case. Where is this? Number 29, with what's called the Schechter Poultry case, or the Sick Chicken case of 1936, the overturning of the NRA. It was the most blatantly socialist measure of the New Deal. So these are the first programs, the first 100-day programs that occur. The 19, or moving into number 19 here, the 1934 midterm elections occur, and FDR and his party are watching anxiously to measure how popular and how well the New Deal has gone over with the first congressional midterm election. FDR sincerely believed he had done his best to try to promote every area of business, manufacturing, banking, farming, workers, all the different things that needed help. He was not trying to play favorites at all. He's trying to help every community. And correspondingly, he expected the vote to come back that way. He thought every community would respond and reward his efforts by voting for him. What they saw instead in the 1934 midterm elections was the upper income banking capitalist community disdainfully voted against him, and the unemployed and the farmers and the working class voted for him. So, yep, and it stung personally. And he felt like, well, if I try to help everybody but only one community appreciates me, then hell with the other community, I'll just help one community. And so there is a personal kind of vengeful feeling that appears in FDR and the party, that starting after 1935 into 36, we'll help those that vote for us. Now, there was still also this effort made to go to states that were traditional Republican states and put more programs in those states to win those people over. But now they're targeting the community we're talking about in those states to be the voters. And this is what's called the Second New Deal. But there is another factor to the Second New Deal other than just watching the outcome of the midterm elections. And that second factor, which I find is probably the most interesting part of the New Deal, was what's called the thunder on the left in item 20, or 19 and 20. It's reasonable to expect that criticism is going to come from the conservative right. They're going to be upset about the taxes, the private property invasions, heavy-handed government policies, taxes on their voting community. So he expected that. He wasn't surprised at all that conservatives would be upset with the New Deal. What he was pretty shocked at was that there was a sizable amount of criticism coming from the far left of him. And these names listed in 20 through 23 are some examples. These are people who complained he isn't going far enough. He's a tool of the banking capitalists. He's trying to preserve free market capitalism. So there's proof that critics were making those complaints. I mean, you'd expect that from Norman Thomas and the Socialist Party, but some of these other people come out of the woodwork and surprise people. The first one, in number 20, is a California doctor named Francis Townsend, medical doctor. Francis Townsend proposed that every American over age 65 should receive a $200 a month pension as long as they live, provided that they spend every penny of it each month. You don't get the next pension until you spend every bit of the first month's pension. $200 a month, which is quite a bit in 1934-35. What's the purpose of compelling all that money to be spent rather than saved? Yeah, it's stimulant. Kind of the thinking is these people don't need to be saving in the long run. That's a bad way to put it. But that's what he would say. Furthermore, it's going to stimulate immediate economic growth for everybody. Most dismissed it as unworkable because how would all that be paid for? But we can see that the old age pension plan of Francis Townsend does come to be reality through what? Social Security. And that's what's down in number 25 below. And this is where I'm going to start making these connections, is that the criticisms of people on the far left worried FDR more than the far right. And so part of the Second New Deal is not only let's not just reward the community that votes for us, but we better watch out, because in 1936 I may not even be the candidate, some socialist might be instead. So we've got to co-opt and steal their thunder in order to stay in power. And that's one of them. It's the creation of the Social Security program was taken from Townsend's ideas. And while we're there, on number 25, comment that it was administered, Social Security, by the Labor Department, and most of the structure of the Social Security program was put together by the Labor Secretary Frances Perkins, the first female to hold an executive cabinet position. In fact, she told FDR, "I will not take this position unless you are reasonably sure about providing old age pension security." So she kind of like pressured him into Social Security. When they were hammering out the program, somebody said, should it just come directly from the tax till? They said, no, people should be paying into it. And the reason for that is they'll feel like they've earned it. But also, better than that, there'll always be somebody vested. So if a politician comes along and wants to just get rid of it and destroy it or change it up, there'll always be some committee, group of people that'll scream, you can't do that with my money. So that was, FDR feared that down the road there'd be people wanting to tamper with Social Security. I'd say invade a few less countries and filter that money over into the pay pot. It's workable. You know what? I have simple patience for this part of the court. We will borrow in the trillions for defense, but we pinch pennies when it comes to keeping ourselves alive in our elder age. Isn't that what security is also about? Well, to quote Mario Cuomo, the resources are there if the political will is there. It can be done. And we're not even to the break point yet. That's 2037. That's light years away. No, it's fixable. Next person. Here we got a few minutes left here. Next person, Charles Coughlin or Coughlin. He goes by both pronunciations. Called the Detroit Radio Priest. Transmitted out of Royal Oak, Michigan. Royal Oak, Michigan is a suburb of Detroit. His criticisms was that FDR wasn't working hard enough to devaluate the coinage. He was a silverite. Not to go into that, but there was an upsurge in silver production, and as we said earlier, a devaluation of the value of gold. So what Coughlin wanted was to try to inflate the money supply, much like the populace had wanted to. And when FDR wouldn't move as far into the devaluation inflationary direction as Coughlin wanted, then he said it's because he is just a patsy tool of the bankers. So that was the great criticism, was that FDR is not really a New Deal liberal. He's just a puppet of the conservative banking elite. And Yes. In other words, FDR did exactly what Coughlin's claiming he's not doing enough of. That's the conference. And then eventually the criticisms moved from being a tool of the bankers to being a tool of the Jewish bankers. And then pretty soon the banking part started to get less, and it was just a tool of the Jewish conspiracy. And that's where Coughlin really went strong on us, that he was really, really into this anti-Semitic rant. And then he became, in the late 30s, very cozy with Hitler's ideas and friends with Lindbergh. Pretty out of the closet Nazi by 1940. But
he got caught up in Hitler.
Yeah. And when we get down to Gerald K. Smith, which we won't make tonight, you'll find that he is a protege of Coughlin and actually is an Arkansas person, eventually we'll mention here. In fact, that's probably a good pause point, and we'll pick up with Huey Long on 22 when we return.